Good morning, everyone. So today's session is going to be on steps 10, 11, and 12. We have from 9 a.m. to 10:45 a.m. So we're going to do our breaks again. So we're going to do 9 a.m. to 9:50 a.m. is going to be 10 and 11. We're going to take a 10-minute break, start up again at 10, and go to 10:45 on step 12. Can I ask if anyone's here for the first time seeing me? You weren't at any of those sessions? Okay, so I'm just going to introduce myself again. My name is Kim G. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater from South Jersey, so I'm from the South Jersey Intergroup. My home group is in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, 9 a.m. On Sunday mornings. I am also a almost daily participant in the Overeaters Anonymous Vision for You Big Book Study phone meeting. I've been in OA since 1994. My top weight is, which there's pictures going around, my top size, because I don't even know my weight. Who gets on a scale once you get over a certain weight? My top size was a size 24. I've also been a size 2, where I lost my menstrual cycle and was underweight in Overeaters Anonymous. And I've also been the size I am now, which is a size 10, binging and purging and over-exercising. So I am an equal opportunity compulsive overeater. I came in 1994, but I've been recovered since January 2011. So you can see there was a little bit of a time difference there, and we talked a lot about that yesterday. So before we even get into steps 10 and 11, what do we need to do before we do 10 and 11? We have to do steps 1 through 9. The simplest way that I heard it said was steps 1 through 9 get you unblocked. Steps 10, 11, and 12 keep you unblocked. Reason I'm stressing that is I often hear people say they put the food down and that motions are coming up and they're really frantic and they have to start doing step 10 now. We can't do step 10 when we're in step 1. Step 10 is a culmination of 4 through 9. Can we mechanically read pages 84 and 85? Can someone actually talk to us and we get a little bit of relief? Absolutely. But until we do 1 through 9 and we're unblocked, the actual practice of 10 and 11 doesn't have depth and weight. And the reason I like to stress that is because I felt like a frickin' loser. Being in the food, trying to do step 10, why isn't it working? And I was under the impression that the steps didn't work because I wasn't getting relief from 10 and 11. But the reality was I wasn't doing the instructions to get to 10 in order to get that feel, that relief that 10 and 11 gives me. And the first one is I have to put the food down. So what did we do this weekend? In doctor's opinion, we learned out what our real problem was. We learned that we have this twofold illness, that we have an allergy of the body, that when we ingest certain substances, we cannot reasonably predict what's going to happen. And the only way we're not going to get that reaction is to not ingest those foods. So first and foremost, I have to get those foods out of my body. Doctor's opinion says that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I cannot get the effect from the steps if I'm still getting the effect from the food. But the greater aspect of our disease is we have this mental twist. I have this mind that tells me it's okay. I have this mind that tells me, well, yeah, I have these allergic foods, but you know what? If I committed it to my sponsor, then it's okay that I eat those foods. It's a mind that tells me I've lost 13 pounds, I've lost 3 pounds, I can have those foods. It's a mind that says it's an exception today. It's in a mind that says, I'm at the OA birthday, and I have a fellowship around me that support me so I can make an exception and have that today. Your body doesn't care when you have it, where you have it. It's going to have that physical reaction. And the bigger problem is I have a mind that tells me it's okay. So that's what the doctor's opinion shows us. Then in Bill's story, I'm given a living, breathing example. What does that look like when I have that medical diagnosis? And I'm asked to identify in. Do I eat like Bill drank? Do I feel like Bill felt? Do I think like Bill thinks? Have I experienced the progression of the illness like Bill Wilson? Did I go from fun and excitement to necessity to oblivion? And then we go into there is a solution. There's a solution tells me a lot about the problem. To know who I am, I have to know who I am not. Dr. Silthworth created Alcoholics Anonymous not for people that have a drinking problem, but for people who have an addiction. People who are of the hopeless variety, the chronic alcoholics, people who are seriously alcoholic as described in the Big Book. So we learned about three different types of compulsive overeaters. We have the moderate eaters that can take it or leave it alone. We have the hard eaters that might even look like us and have consequences of their eating, but given a sufficient reason, they can stop or moderate. And then we have the real compulsive overeaters, about 10% of the population that Dr. Silkworth said that suffers from an illness described in the big book. So the question is, am I part of that 10%? And our fellowship includes people who are not part of that 10%, and it can be confusing to us who are the 10%. One of the things I was talking with someone yesterday about is my brother is a diabetic. He's an insulin-dependent diabetic. He has to take insulin in the morning and insulin at night. There are non-insulin-dependent diabetics. I always forget which ones are type 1 and type 2. But if he went to a diabetic support group and the people who are not insulin-dependent came up to my brother and said, listen, Scott, I'm a diabetic too. I control it through diet and exercise. I take these pills. I don't need to take insulin. We're both diabetics, dude. Don't take your insulin. You will be fine. My brother would die if he didn't take his insulin. So I have to know who and what I am. If there's people in the fellowship that do not need to do these steps, that do not need to refrain from their substances 100%, I celebrate that for them. But for me, I have to know if I believe that message, I will die. So the real compulsive overeater needs to be with the real compulsive overeater. The hard eater can help another hard eater. The moderate eater can help another moderate eater. And we can all be in Overeaters Anonymous. But I have to know who and what I am. And there's a solution tells me who and what I am. More About Alcoholism tells me why I have to come to Overeaters Anonymous. Because More About Alcoholism is not about the allergy anymore. Because really, if I have a one-fold illness, put me in a rehab and I'll come out 28 days later, no allergic response, and you can tell me, and Nancy Reagan can come back and tell me just say no, and I'll be able to do that. That whole chapter is about why I have to do the steps, because step one does not tell me don't eat no matter what, don't eat. Step one tells me I'm going to eat, unless I have a spiritual awakening. And then we go into the chapter we agnostic, steps two. We talked about some of my prejudices. I thought step two, I had to return to my childhood religion. I thought I had to believe in God. I thought I had to find God. That's not what We Agnostics is about. We Agnostics is trying to help us come to the conclusion, do you need a power? Does your step one experience convince you that you need a power greater than yourselves? You don't know what that power is. You don't even care what that power is if you're really in step two. You just know you need something greater than yourself. And then we went over step three and how it works. Step three, I thought, was turning my life and my will over to God. And if he didn't do what I wanted, I would quote unquote take it back. Step three is recognizing in those pages 60 to 63, what is life like when you're in charge? What is life like when you're in self-will? And if you came to the same conclusion I did, that it's a total shit show when Kim's in charge, I come to a decision to learn a different way of living. I don't turn anything over in step three. I make the decision to learn how to do that. And then we quickly went through steps 4 through 9, because how do I learn how to do that? I do that through steps 4 through 9. And there's a lot of different approaches to this, to doing an inventory. So what I wanted to make clear yesterday was, what is the big book approach? I have found for myself it is the simplest approach, it's the quickest approach, and it's the most effective approach. If you use other approaches and they are effective for you, I celebrate that. Keep doing that. Share that with people and see if that works. But if you are doing other methods and it's not working and you continue to relapse, I really highly suggest you try the simple method that Big Book does. So the Big Book gives us an inventory in step 4 of 3 inventories. We look at our resentments, we look at our fears, and we look at our sex conduct. It's a series of lists. In step 5, we have another human being here that who is not invested in our life, who can give us objective feedback to help us see those patterns of how we've been living that hasn't been working. And through that process, in that fourth column, we identify our character defects. We are selfish, we're dishonest, we're self-seeking, and we're fighting, and we turn that over to God. Not me. I don't work on my defects. I don't work on opposites. I acknowledge these things aren't working, and I ask a power greater than myself to remove them. And then in 8 and 9, now that I've been confronted with my defects, I've been confronted with how I react, I make a list of people I have harmed, and I go out and I make amends. I correct those harms. I admit where I am wrong. I ask for forgiveness. And what that does is it brings me freedom and it unblocks me from this power that has always been deep down inside me. This is not a religious program. It's a spiritual program. You can be atheistic and recover. You can be agnostic and recover. You can believe in any dogma you want to, and you can recover. And once we are unblocked, this is where the rubber hits the road. We're going to talk today about 10 and 11. Now that I have this skill set, what do I do now? When I'm going through 4 through 9, I have the luxury of looking back at the last 20, 30, 40 years of my life. But what do I do now when the jerk's right in front of me? How do I get unblocked now? I know I felt my whole life, if I got down to a size 6, I would open up the door and Brad Pitt would be there on his knee with a diamond ring. I naively thought, too, I'd get to step 12 and everything would go my way. The reason I need 10, 11 is because life continues to happen whether I'm eating or not or whether I'm recovered or not. So how do I make sure that mental twist doesn't come back so that my mind tells me it's okay to eat the food that I'm allergic to? So step 10 is going to give me that immediate relief. Step 11 is going to be 3 practices where we're kind of looking at almost like a step 5. We're going to look back at the last 24 hours. Use a 4 through 9 to see how we're doing. We're going to get up in the morning. We're going to try to reset. I call it a proactive 4 through 9. I know what's going to trip me up, right? I'm selfish. I'm dishonest. I'm self-seeking. I'm frightened. Why not ask God to remove them before I even suffer from them? And then I'm going to pause throughout the day. I kind of think of it like taking my spiritual temperature. How am I doing today? Am I connected in? Because I understand if I get disconnected, I'm going to pick up again. So let's go into the book. Actually, there's two readings I wanted to do. I'm just going to highlight a couple things. This is a reading about Clarence Snyder, who's the guy that started AA. Dr. Bob brought him through the steps, and he was from Cleveland. And in the 1940s, they had a recovery rate of like 90%. And this was the first group that really used the big book. Because prior to that, in Akron, New York, they were all working these Oxford tenets. And then when Bill wrote the big book, the Cleveland was the first one to actually use the book. So I just wanted to highlight a couple things that Clarence said. So Clarence believed that the difference between New York and Midwest AA was the approach to sobriety. In Ohio, the approach was trust God, clean house, and help others. Clarence felt the approach in New York was don't drink and go to meetings. Emphasis on spirituality was what made Ohio AA so successful, according to Clarence. He noticed that New York AA had but a few members who were maintaining any sort of abstinence from alcohol, and that most Ohio members had achieved what was to become permanent sobriety and had numerous strong AA meetings in evidence. Moreover, Clarence thought that if the primary purpose of AA was only to stop drinking, and in order to maintain abstinence, only going to AA meetings, AA was doomed to failure. Clarence remembered Dr. Bob once saying, "There's an easy way and a hard way to recover from alcoholism. The hard way is just going to meetings." So I just want to say that because we're getting a lot of incredible information this weekend, right? From all these different workshops and all these different experiences. If we don't go home and practice that, if we don't go home and practice this spiritual program, see, because I thought attending meetings was doing the steps. I thought reading the books was doing the steps. I thought discussing the steps was doing the steps. I thought critiquing the steps was doing the steps. Doing the steps is actually doing the instructions, and that's what's going to give us permanent recovery. And the other thing is that I like to study when AA was at its apex. Sometimes I think we idolize AA. AA is struggling just like OA is struggling. Their recovery rates are in the toilet the way our recovery rates are in the toilet. So I like this. When were they at their apex? It was in the 40s, right before that second edition came out, when they talk about 75% recovery rates. So I have an AA preamble from 1940. So I just wanted to read a couple lines from that. This is how serious they took it. "Our condition may be the result of an allergy, which makes us different from other people. It has never been by any treatment with which we are familiar permanently cured. The only relief we have to offer is absolute abstinence, the second meaning of AA. There are no dues or fees. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Each member squares his debt by helping others to recover." An Alcoholics Anonymous is an alcoholic who, through application and adherence to the AA program, has forsworn the use of any and all alcoholic beverages in any form. The moment he takes so much as one drop of beer, wine, spirits, or any other alcoholic beverage, he automatically loses all status as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA is not interested in sobering up drunks who are not sincere in their desire to remain sober for all time. Not being reformers, we offer our experience only to those who want it. That sounds serious. And we're actually going to talk about that in step 12, because I don't want to just talk about sponsoring one-on-one. What are our meetings doing? What are our inner groups doing? What is our world service doing? Are we taking our disease as seriously as the AA people are? You know, one of the sayings I heard is in AA, they take the disease seriously and themselves lightly. But in OA, we take ourselves seriously and the disease lightly. So I want to talk about that at 10 o'clock. So let's get into step 10. If we turn to page 84, we've gone through step 9. We've reviewed that information. We're starting to make our amends. And in that second full paragraph, it says, this thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. So it's letting us know once we make that first amends, we are in the trenches. Life is continuing to happen. We don't wait till all of our amends are completed before we start working step 10. We have a skill set now that needs to be used. Because I have to tell you, if I had to wait till all my amends were completed, I still would not have started step 10. I told you about my college roommate yesterday. I have never found her. I've had suggestions and made multiple attempts to find this girl. But see, I'm so self-centered, I don't even remember how to spell her last name. But I have not found her. So if I had to wait, I wouldn't even be starting step 10 now. So we vigorously commence this way of living as we clean up the past. We have entered the world of the spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. How I've personalized this for me is understanding is I'm always going to be a student. I am always seeking new information about these 12 steps, new information about spiritual leaders, new information about how I can connect with this higher power. And then my effectiveness is I'm a teacher. How can I more effectively help other people? One of my favorite lines by Dr. Bob is, they asked him, what's different today than it was 10 years ago when AA started? And he got quiet for a couple of minutes, and he said, I can now say in 1 hour what it used to take me 6 hours to say. So I'm challenging myself. How can I help more people? I was telling Harlan at breakfast, I'm going to take four people who are in relapse who know the big book and four people who are recently recovered, and we're going to spend a weekend at my house and see what we can do. Never have done it. Don't know what's going to work, but I want to try it. I want to try to see. Oh, just saying I'm trying to grow in helping people. So one of the things I'm going to try is I'm going to try to grab four people who have relapsed who've done the big book so they know the book. Four people that are, in 10, 11, and 12, but kind of shaky. And we're going to spend a weekend at my house, and we're going to go through the steps and see what happens. Yes. No, local people. Okay, you're scaring me. Okay. All right. So here comes the actual instructions, right? So every day I'm going to be a teacher, and every day I'm going to be a student. That's how I stay connected to these steps. So it says it continues for a lifetime. Continue. Now, so basically 10 is a 4 through 9, right? So continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. So that's that fourth column, right? We're watching for it. We're not working on our defects. We're watching for it. So there's our fourth column, the fourth step. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. There's our 6 and 7. We discuss them with someone immediately. There's our step 5. We make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. There's our 8 and 9. And then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help, which is step 12. So I am doing a 4 through 9 when something is disturbing me. Now you notice it's not 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It's 4, 6, 7, 5, 8, 9. Because now I'm connected with a power. So what I did in the beginning is I wanted to practice this skill set. And I'll tell you why I did it this way. I was a very shy kid. And when I was in college and I was graduating, one of the best advice I got from a counselor was, he said, Kim, why don't you do a bunch of interviews for jobs that you don't want, so that when you have the job interview for the job you do want, you're going to feel comfortable with interviewing. So I wanted to practice this skill set when it didn't really need it. So when I really needed it, I was going to feel comfortable with the skill set. So this was 9 years ago, before I had a smartphone. So I would take index cards into work, and I am someone that happens to go to the bathroom a lot. So every time I went to the bathroom, I'd take an index card and I'd write on there SDRF, selfish, dishonest, resentful, fearful. And I have to tell you, I was blown away, because I would get to work at 8 o'clock feeling good, go to the bathroom at 9:30, and I realized I had been riddled with selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Because see, anxiety was so normal for me, I couldn't tell when I was disturbed. So by practicing that, now I'm going to tell you something, I not that I differ from, but I interpret differently than other big book people, is we discuss it with someone immediately. I believe immediately in 1939 is different than in 2019. They didn't have cell phones. They didn't have texting. They didn't have Twitter and Facebook. I think they meant don't sit on it. I don't have a job where I can call someone immediately. But I don't want to not do my 10 steps. So what I did in the beginning is I would call someone and say, hey, can I call you tomorrow night at 7 o'clock and review some 10 steps with you? And I would do my index cards and have 3, 4, 5 of them, and I would call that person at night and I would review my 10 steps. So as I continue to do this and continue, I don't call someone every single time I do a 10 step. I'll tell you, for me personally, after a couple years, there started to be themes. You're going to be taken advantage of. They're going to figure out that you're a loser. And as soon as that theme came up when I did my 10th step, I'm like, okay, God, take this from me. Take this from me. But when I did my 11th step at night and I reviewed it and I saw that same thing kept coming up 3 and 4 times that day, I knew I needed to talk to another human being. I needed someone who could objectively look at what I was doing. I'll give you an example of a 10th step that went totally down the rabbit hole. And my friend who I called, I texted her the next day. First things first, fuck you. Second thing, thank you. Because she got me to some real truths. You know, I was angry at someone in an OA meeting. And what I found was, it was because it was a man. And I have this thing where I defer to men. And that I don't think I can question a man. And when he tried to approach me about something, I felt this pull that I had to reciprocate. And what she got me to was, what if a woman did the same thing? And I know exactly how I would have handled it, like with a woman. I would have said, no, I don't want any contact with you. I don't want to talk to you. But I was doing it because differently because he was a man. And unfortunately, that got me to a problem I was having with my neighbor, who's calling the cops because my dog barks. And I realized it was because he was a guy. If a female neighbor would have had, I would have gone up and talked to that neighbor. We would have talked about it. But I felt, because he was a guy, that I was supposed to defer to him. And I'll tell you, that got me into not only just some good 10 work, it got me into some good 11 work. And that's what I said. I was so angry when she was pointing. I just wanted her to tell me I was right. You know, this guy's a jackass. Tell me that. That's what I wanted to hear. But no, she got me to some core beliefs that I had to question. And now I have, which we talked about a little bit, but I have ideals that I work on. So with this person, I just decided that I don't want any contact with him. If it was a woman, I just would be, not in judgment, in discernment. It's just someone I choose not to interact with. I think sometimes we think we should all love each other in Overeaters Anonymous. You have a group of 1,000 people here. There's going to be some people you don't get along with. And that's okay. It's not okay to trash them. It's not okay to gossip about them. But we can choose who we hang out with. And then I have this thing with my neighbor. So I'm, you know, right now it's good. It's in the winter and my one dog is hurt, so she can't be outside a lot. But when it starts to get warm again, I'm going to have to talk to the township and see what's going on. I might have to see why. What I also found out is, one of the reasons I hate this guy is because of all the conversations I've had in my head with him that he's unaware of. So I have to do some work on that. All the conversations I've had in my head with him that he is totally unaware of. So that's how we use 10 and 11, yes? I write how I, right now, where am I being selfish? Where am I being dishonest? Where am I being resentful? Where am I being fearful? What do I do with SDRF? Am I just making a check mark that I have it, or am I writing about it? I do bullet points. That's why I like index cards. That's why I like a spreadsheet, because I can't pontificate and try to convince people I'm right. It's very, very short. It's on there. Now, for me, again, notice how it doesn't tell me in this directions to go to steps one, you know, the columns 1, 2, and 3. Because the 1, 2, and 3 is the story. So when I call someone with the 10-step, or someone calls me with the 10-step, and they start telling me the story, I try to stop them. I don't care about the story. What? Tell me it from a totally different angle. Where are you being selfish? Where are you being dishonest? Where are you being resentful? And have you gone to God with your defects yet? Because a lot of times, especially with women, we like to talk about stuff, right? And you know what? That can be very helpful. It just happens not to be step work. So for example, again, with me, a couple years ago, my other dog was getting really sick. He's the first dog I've ever had. I've never had to put a dog down. I don't know a lot of stuff about dogs. So I had to do 10-step work because I was being selfish, dishonest, resentful, and fearful. I had to create an ideal as a dog owner how I could advocate for this dog and not get into trying to get this dog to stay alive because I feel better, right? What am I willing to do and not willing to do financially for this dog? I'm not willing to pay for cancer treatment or something along those lines. How inner thing. That was my step work. But I also had to call dog owners and talk about how scared I was. I also had to talk to dog owners about what happened when they put their dog down. I mean, the big thing for me is I want to be in that room as much as it scares me. He's still with us. Ironically, he's the healthy one now. My other one's having a problem. I mean, he's on a lot of medication, but he's healthy. But I had to talk to people because I needed that as a woman and as a human being to talk about stuff. But I had to make sure that was separate from my step work. Does that make sense to everybody? So this is a very specific skill set that we're going to do. Now, the 10-step is broken up into 3 different areas, I think. We just went over the instructions. There's also the 10-step promises and also the 10-step warnings. So the promises, I mentioned this yesterday. I wish we read these promises instead of the 9-step promises. I didn't come here to not regret my past. I came here because I wanted to stop eating. I wanted the food to shut up in my head. And that's what these 10th promises tell us. Why don't we read them? Part of it, I think, is because we don't believe it's possible. But that's true in a lot of 12-step fellowships. So it says here, we ceased fighting anything or anyone, dash, even alcohol. This is the bottom of page 84. So it's almost like alcohol is an afterthought because I don't think of food. You know, I remember when I was, once again, I was using Disrespecting Overeaters Anonymous and using it as a diet group with group support. And every time I would call someone with something, the first question was, how's your food? How's your food? How's your food? That seems insane to me now. But the reason that everyone asked that was because we didn't have a spiritual answer. So everything was about keeping on guard for your food. Now, if I'm upset about something and I talk to a fellow, they'll say, how's your 10 and 11 work? Who are you working with? When's the last time you did an 11th step? Because that's what keeps me connected. And that way the food is in the background. I haven't had a food dream or a food thought in years. I'll tell you one funny thing. My office, we had to start having weekly meetings a couple years ago. And my boss said, well, what can I make you guys do to do these meetings? And the other girl said, well, if you bring us fresh cookies, we'll do this meeting. And I'm like, so we were having these fresh cookies every week. And then someone said, well, we got to stop these cookies. These are not compulsive overeaters. My pants are starting not to fit. Put the cookies near Kim where they'll be safe. I said, I want that on video. But that's the truth, because I didn't care that there were cookies there. It doesn't bother me. I don't get angry what other people enjoy. And I find it fascinating to watch people. Even every holiday, I'm fascinated that people leave 2 cookies laying on a platter for like 2 weeks in my office because they're not compulsive overeaters. But I'm not angry about it. It's not on my radar. So it says, we will seldom be interested in lecture. It doesn't say never. So once again, we talked about it being a dimmer switch. You've gone through these steps. Are your food thoughts becoming less frequent and less intense? If tempted, we recoil as if from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally. We'll find this has happened automatically. We will see that our attitude towards liquor has been given to us without any effort on our part. The way that I describe this experience for me is I spent 17 years in OA, and I would put the food down, and I would face the food, and I would fight it with everything I had, meetings, sponsors, phone calls, literature, and the food pummeled me every frickin' time. But when I was finally done, when I couldn't live with the food and I couldn't live without the food, when I couldn't get drunk and when I couldn't get sober, I put the food down 100% and I faced the solution and ran at it with everything I had. And you know what? I still went to meetings, but I went to meetings that were solution-based and not mired in disease. I made phone calls to people who were recovered and were solution-based and not the people I knew that would buy my bullshit and tell me it's okay to have dessert as long as my sponsor said I could do it. I still use the literature. And it seemed like when I focused like that, I turned around and thought, I haven't thought about food in 2 weeks. I haven't thought about food in a month. I haven't thought about food in 2 months. So really wasn't even what I was doing is where were my intentions? What was my goal? Was my goal just to live one day at a time, not eating the food and hopefully not getting fat again? Or was my goal to have a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps so I could have freedom from this allergy and freedom from this mental twist? It says, we are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. I'm just going to say this from my own experience. I had many years in OA where the whole thing was you can't go to a restaurant, you can't go to a celebration, you can't go to a wedding. And it was cheered. It was absolutely cheered. I remember being in this one meeting where this girl, we've both been in OA the same amount of time, and she said she finally found the solution, that she'd been abstinent for 90 days, her son had gone to college, so she goes in the room when she really wants to eat, and she'll listen to phone meetings for 8 hours and not sleep all night, and that's how she's staying abstinent. And now I was new in recovery, and I know that I can come off pretty harsh and in your face, but believe me, I've softened a lot. So this was like 8-9 years ago, and I just remember saying, I am just so glad that I don't have to sit in a room all night. I just did the steps, and I'm free. Now, I shouldn't have said it in that way, but it's my truth. I don't want a life where I have to sit in a room and listen to phone meetings 8 hours a day in order to stay abstinent. I don't want to not participate in my family activities because I'm afraid of what they're serving. I want to be able to participate in life and be, it doesn't mean I don't make adjustments. I went to a 50th birthday for my friend, and I was going to see a lot of people from grammar school and high school, which makes me nervous because I was such an awkward dork, and because of my food addiction, I don't remember a lot of stuff. And it's supposed to be at 6 o'clock, and we're supposed to have dinner right away. Non-compulsive overeaters don't mean 6 o'clock when they say 6 o'clock. So I chose to eat beforehand. They didn't serve dinner till 8 o'clock. I took the food on my plate, moved it around a little bit so nobody would know I wasn't eating, and I had the most wonderful time. So yes, I'm a compulsive overeater, and I might have to make accommodations, but I'm free to enjoy what's going on around me. I don't have to avoid people, places, and things. I don't have to avoid triggers. I don't have to be worried about hungry, angry, lonely, tired in the sense that that's what's going to make me eat again. I am in neutrality. I am safe and protected. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. And that is my experience again. I was either like, look at me, I'm a size 4 and everyone should do my food plan. Or I was like, oh my God, that person's in relapse. Oh, I can't be near them. I can't be near them. I can't be near them. Cocky or afraid, I'm neither today. That is our experience as long as we react, so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. You know, I think of an athlete, like there's a guy, the South Jersey Intergroup, actually he was our chair, I think he's the Region 7 chair now, but he's a marathon guy. He actually ran 12 marathons in a year in order for some charity. I don't think he just gets up and runs that marathon that one day a month, right? He's got to be in training. He's got to keep himself in fit spiritual and fit physical condition. That's what I have to do here. Those spiritual muscles have to be worked out. A spiritual teacher I love, she said, in order to get physically fit, we have to move. in order to get spiritually fit, we have to get still. And that's so important for me. I have to have that quiet time in the morning. I have to have that quiet time at night. I have to create a pause for myself. That's how I say spiritually fit. Now, here comes the warnings, which I love the warnings. I think the promises are very inspirational, but I don't know about you, but I'm much more inspired by the what could happen if I don't do it than the promises. So it says it's easy to let up on our spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. I always thought people picked up because something really bad happened. I have to tell you, my experience over these last 9 years is I see a lot of people picking up because good stuff is happening. Because if I'm getting my way, who needs God? Why do work if I'm getting what I want? And then when life happens, good or bad, suddenly we're knocked on our butt and we're out for the count. So if I can only talk about a spiritual experience I had 3 years ago, I'm in big trouble. If I'm only doing the work that was required of me and when I recovered 9 years ago, I'm in deep trouble. I have to continue to grow. For those of you that are married, if you got on that altar and said, I do, and never talked to that person again, do you think you'd still be married? Is your marriage the same as a newlywed as it is when you first had children, as when your kids are growing up and now you might be empty nesters? That relationship needs to grow and be tended to or it falls apart. It's the same thing with our relationship with power and our relationship with these steps. I have to continue to grow. We are not cured of alcoholism. So for those of you who think that word recovered is arrogant, they're telling you right now specifically, we are not cured. I talked a lot about yesterday, but I have a really bad ankle injury. I'm recovered. None of you would probably even know I had a broken ankle and was told I wasn't going to be able to walk again. I'm recovered from that injury. But when it comes to my flying, my ankle starts to hurt me. If I'm not doing my yoga, my ankle starts to hurt me. Certain weather conditions, I can't wear heels anymore because my foot won't point in a certain way. So I know I'm not cured of that ankle injury, but I am recovered. I am asymptomatic of having that ankle injury. The same way that I am a compulsive overeater, but I do not suffer from compulsive overeating today because of these steps. It says what we have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. So I believe that every 12-step program has taken this and watered it down to one day at a time, white-knuckling our food, our alcohol, our drugs. The big book never says one day at a time when it comes to our allergy. This is the first time it introduces it, that this mental twist, we have a daily reprieve. So this is the way I personally have personalized it, is I'm Cinderella. So every night I get to go to the ball, but when I come home, my dress turns to rags, the carriage turns to a pumpkin, the groomsmen turn to mice, and I wake up every morning untreated. But I have a treatment that if I use it every day, that I can go to the ball every single night. I don't know about you all, but if I was binging my brains out on a Sunday, I never woke up Monday morning and thought, whew, I'm good till Thursday. Don't need to do any more of that. But how many of you, maybe after this incredible weekend, will wake up on Monday morning going, yeah, I don't need to go to a meeting. I don't need to make phone calls. I'm good. That was enough for this weekend. We think that's going to carry us. I needed to eat every day, and I needed to do the spiritual work every single day. So it says the next one, every day is a day we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. I mentioned this yesterday, too. I like to take different parts of the big book and use it as part of my 11th step. I use this as part of my 11th step a lot. Every day. Am I doing it every day? Am I taking off because I happen to be in LA? Nope, my spiritual practice has continued this weekend. Am I carrying God's vision or Kim's vision into the world? And am I carrying it into all my activities? We talked a lot about this. If I am using the steps in 98% of my life, that 2% is going to take me out. Where do I think that these steps are not relevant? Where do I think that power is not relevant? And that's exactly where I'm going to relapse over. So after we get through this step 10, I'm feeling some urgency, right? I'm looking at the stuff there that's happening today because I know that I can't stay in that disturbance. One of the fallacies in all 12-step programs is we do step 10 at night. I think about it now. Why, if I'm upset at 9 a.m., do I have to wait till 9 p.m. to get undisturbed? That sounds crazy. So step 10 is the walking around step. If we go to page 86, We're going to see three practices that are for step 11. So the evening review is when we retire at night, and we're basically taking those 4 through 9 questions. And we're not just looking at a specific event. We're looking at over the past 24 hours. Now, the big difference I see between the step 10 and the step 11 at night is two questions. What could I have done better? And what corrective measures should be taken? Because if all I do is 10 steps just to get undisturbed in the moment and don't change, I'm going to be doing the same damn 10 steps for the next 20 years. So what could I have done better? What corrective measures? What can I do tomorrow? This is, for me personally, where these ideals we talked about yesterday really come into play. So I look at my relationship with my parents, what's going on right now. I look at what my ideal for my parents is, and the difference between the two is what I could have done better. And asking God into it, I ask how tomorrow I can behave differently to work towards that ideal. Okay, I asked for a concrete example of that. Right now, my parents are aging rapidly. My dad's 82, my mom's 77. They are aging differently. My dad's a big, bad Marine who can barely get up from the couch now. Used to run marathons and everything. He's physically in really bad shape. My mom does yoga and can... I talk about being Catholic. My mom walks on a treadmill for 33 minutes every day because that's how old Jesus was when he died. That's what my mom does. Everything has symbols, my mom. So physically, she's fabulous, but her memory is getting really bad. And I've been saying, well, how can I be useful to them? And I am their kid. They do dismiss me a lot. So one of the things I did in the fall is I looked into 55-plus communities in my area that have one story, because I don't think my dad's going to be able to do steps. Prayed a lot about that, researched them, presented it to my parents. They thought it was a good idea for 24 hours, and they decided they're not going to do it. I'm concerned about what they're telling their doctor. Are they letting him know what's going on? So I prayed about it, and on New Year's Day, I asked my parents if it's okay if I go to their next doctor's visit. They rolled their eyes at me, and shockingly, they called me. They had an appointment on Monday. They made the appointment when I can go, and I'm going to go to their next doctor's appointment. So what I'm going to be now praying on is, what do I do in that doctor's appointment? You know, I have a friend that's a doctor. I'm going to ask her. I definitely want to get the HIPAA stuff taken care of. But I really am, right now in my work, I'm feeling like I need to just listen. Because I think if I say stuff, they probably won't invite me back. But I want to see, what is my mom mentioning her memory issues? Is my dad just, my dad's, and I told my dad this actually on New Year's Day, that he talks about his friends who had MS and how they just sucked it up. His friend who had cancer and never complained. And it's like this honor thing, like this Marine tough guy thing. And I'm wondering, he's just thinking he's just suffer with this arthritis and not getting any treatment. So I don't know what he's saying to the doctor, and I don't know what the doctor's saying to him. So I'm going to go to that visit, and we're going to see what's going to happen. So that's how I use it. Well, I want to be involved with their medical decisions because I'm concerned about them. So how do I do that in a way that's respectful for them and that they'll allow me to do? I made my dad laugh because when I asked him about, you know, moving to a 55-plus community, my parents still live in the house I was born. My parents had My parents had a hard time getting pregnant. So they were 4 years married, couldn't get pregnant, decided they were going to adopt, bought a house in New Jersey, moved into the house, and I was born 9 months later. So once the pressure was off to get pregnant, my mom got pregnant. So they still live in that house. So I said to my dad, is this sentimental? I mean, do you feel like you don't want to leave your home because you've lived there for 50 years? And he looked at me and he goes, no, I just don't want to be bothered with selling the house and packing up 50 years worth of stuff. And I said, oh, so you'd rather me do it while I'm grieving your death? And he went, oh, I'll have to think about that one. Like, so it's always this push and pull. You know, and my mom, you know, I told her, I said, what's scaring me is not your memory, because that's just, my mom always had a bad memory. She's angry and she's fearful. And she's like, what do you mean? I said, you called me at work to tell me to go home because it was raining hard, Mom. I said, you're fearful. And then, well, anyways, but so sometimes I do well and sometimes I don't. And that's why corrective measures should be taken. Because just because I'm doing step work doesn't mean they're going to agree with what I want to do. I am their kid. That's what I'm finding out more and more. I'm their kid. I'm not their caretaker in that way. So does that help out there? Okay, so then we also have this upon awakening. So to me, it's almost this proactive. I'm going to ask God in before I'm getting disturbed, right? Why do I have to wait till I'm disturbed? So the second paragraph on 86, on awakening. So I'm just going to point out a couple things for because of time. One of my favorites is we ask God to direct our thinking, and especially asking to be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. I love that word divorce. What do we divorce? Something we once loved. I loved my self-pity. I loved my selfishness. I loved my self-centeredness. But now I know it's killing me. So I'm going to ask God to separate me from these things I once loved. It talks here on page 87, top three lines down from the bottom, being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God. It's not probable that we're going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption and all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. So when I make a fool out of myself, I think to myself, I'm practicing step 11. I just had an absurd action and idea. And I'm inexperienced. For those of you that are parents, when you first find out you're pregnant, you're terrified. I don't know how to be a mom. And then you have that kid and you start to feel comfortable with an infant and the damn thing turns into a toddler. And suddenly you don't know what to do with the toddler. And then it goes off to kindergarten and they become a tween and then they're an adult. So even though you're experienced as a mother, you're constantly inexperienced because the child is changing. It's the same with my recovery. I know how to be 1 year abstinent and recovered. I have no clue how to be 9 years abstinent and recovered. So I just wanted to, I always like to do stuff that's current. So I was reading some Step 11 stuff yesterday, and I just want to share two things that writing really hit me. That meditation is a sacred silence in where we find right actions to match our values. That's kind of like the ideals. And this is another definition of contemplation. A deliberate seeking of God through willingness to detach from self-tyranny of emotions, from self, tyranny of emotions, and false promises of the world. I need that because that's the insanity in my head. And the last thing is pausing. We're going to pause throughout the day. Now, once again, for me, I always was looking, I love when OA said emotions. Emotions is part of our illness. The big book never mentions emotions. I can chase emotions all over. It's a big freaking roller coaster. When I address this mental twist, I'm given the 11th step promise on 88 that says, we are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, and foolish decisions. What I find is if I work on this spiritual program and I work on this mental twist, the emotions take care of themselves. If I'm chasing those emotions, they're going to get more and more erratic. So it says here, we become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily, for we're not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. So I take my spiritual temperature. Am I exhausted? Am I feeling inefficient? If I am, it's probably because I started trying to run the show again. How many times does that happen? I'm lucky if it only happens 4 times in a day. Because once again, I'm a human being. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to pause in. We're going to check in. We're going to do our step 10s. We're going to do our step 11s. But once again, why they have depth and weight is because we've done through 1 through 9. If we pick up, we're blocked again. So we need to go back to step 1, have a new step 1 experience, go back through the steps. Doesn't mean we have to do it with the same intensity, but we need a new experience because something in us got disconnected. And I need to get connected again before I can start practicing 10, 11 in order to have that depth and weight. So we have 2 minutes. I'm going to say one more thing. So we're not going to have time for questions. The last sentence. We alcoholics are undisciplined, so we let God discipline us in the simple way we just outlined. So the simple way we just outlined are the steps. And I have to tell you, we're going to talk about step 12, but this is one of the reasons I sponsor the way I do, because my job is to help someone to get a connection with God, not a connection with me. So at this point, they should be disciplining, getting their discipline from God, even though I've helped them discipline up to this point. So I consider my sponsees really co-fellows. I am there to support them. I am there to share my experience, but we are now co-fellows in recovery, and their job is to go out and help the next suffering compulsive overeater and ask God into that. So it is 9:49, and we are going to get together at 10 o'clock, and we're going to cover step 12. So we're going to get started again, and we're going to start talking about step 12, and we have that till 10:45, and we'll be done the whole workshop. So welcome, if anyone's here who wasn't here earlier today. My name is Kim G, and I'm a recovered compulsive overeater from South Jersey Inner Group. My home group is in Cherry Hill, New Jersey on Sunday mornings at 9 a.m., and I'm also an almost daily participant in the Big Book Overeaters Anonymous meeting, Vision for You phone meeting. So step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to the still suffering compulsive overeater and practice these principles in all of our affairs. So first of all, and I mentioned this kind of yesterday as a joke, but I do mean it. Step 12 is step 12 because we've had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. I think if Bill and Bob wanted us to sponsor after step one, they would have made step 12 step two. If they wanted us to sponsor after step three, they would have made step 12 step four. So the reason that I can sponsor now at step 12 is I've had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. And specifically for Overeaters Anonymous, why I find this so critical is if I don't have neutrality around my own food, how am I going to help someone find neutrality around their food? Because I'm going to start to inflict my food plan or my abstinence on somebody else because I don't have neutrality around my own food. So I think it's so essential that we go through these steps because my sponsee's abstinence might be totally different. A lot of us are going to overlap, but our abstinence could be totally different. So I need the neutrality around my own food so I can objectively help someone else identify what their abstinence is. We try to carry this message. It doesn't say that we successfully carry this message. That my benefit of step 12 is in carrying the message, not whether or not people recover or not. And then practicing these principles in all of our affairs, the Big Book talks about it in three chapters. It talks about it in to the wives, the family afterwards, and to the employers. We're not going to talk about that today. But that's where those chapters will address what life is like after you've completed step 12 and how you interact outside of the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous. So if we go to page 89, and it's the chapter Working with Others. That first sentence, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. I don't know about you all, but I love the idea of having immunity from my eating. And there's a gentleman, he's not in AA. He actually did his doctoral thesis in the 70s on Alcoholics Anonymous. And he wrote about the history, you know, he's a historian. So he was writing about it not from a spiritual perspective, but a historical perspective. And I just found some things interesting. Like he felt one of the reasons AA was able to grow the way it did was because of the Great Depression. And a lot of these guys were out of work. So they had hours and hours to work with people. He talked about the spread of AA in the 40s. He felt had a lot to do with World War II because a lot of these guys were getting drafted and being put across the country. So AA was able to grow in different parts of the country. So I just found it fascinating that way. But one of the things he said was that he feels that AA worships the first 100 too much. And that a lot of AA success is on the people who died. Their failures taught them as much as their successes. So sometimes I actually like to flip a sentence. So I like to read this sentence sometimes saying, practical experience shows that those who don't work with others eat again. Because I really thought sponsoring was for the gurus. Like the inner group people should be sponsoring people. I think that one of the biggest differences in my recovery these last 9 years is I understand that sponsoring is how I stay sober. It is by going through this book is a wonderful experience as a sponsee, but I didn't learn the book until I started taking other people through the book. And that last, the first sentence of the last paragraph says, perhaps you're not acquainted with any drinkers who want to recover. I have to tell you that I am acquainted with a lot of compulsive overeaters. I am not acquainted with a lot who want to recover. I know a lot that want to get skinny. I know a lot of people that want their family off their backs about their weight, whether they're underweight or overweight or bulimic. I know a lot of people that want support and from their emotions and want to just be able to bitch and moan in meetings and have people tell them that they love them. But I don't know a lot of people that want to do the work. So that's who I'm looking for. I'm looking for people who actually want to recover. So when I get to this part in my, no, Well, the question is, how do I discern that? I don't really know, in the sense that I can tell you who's going to recover or not. I know how I carry the message, and if someone's willing to do the work, join me. If they're not willing to do the work, that's okay too, but I'm not going to continue to work with someone who's not going to do the work. So it's that saying I said yesterday, your actions are so loud, I cannot hear a word that you're saying. They talk about later in the book that, you know, are you willing to go to any lengths? I think every person who's been to more than 2 12-step programs will say yes to that until you ask them to do something. So when I get to this point with my sponsees, I kind of say, okay, I want you to get quiet with your higher power and ask how you can most effectively carry this message. What I think is beautiful is a lot of us, we all have different personalities and we all carry the message differently. There's people that have daily contact with their sponsees. There's people that have, you know, I personally talk to people 3 days a week and I do a lot of phone work. I have sponsees that I've taken through on the phone who don't like the phone and will only sponsor face to face. You know, I take the people through the steps at about 2 to 3 months. I know people that can do it in 2 to 3 weeks. I know people that can do it in 8 or 9 months. The fact is that diversity is a strength of ours, because I believe in the choreography of God. People are going to be drawn to us that we can help. So I ask them, get quiet. How can you most effectively carry the message? From something as simple as, are you a morning person, an afternoon, or an evening person? I only sponsor at night. I wouldn't pay attention in the morning, and right after work, I'm too busy with my dogs. I wouldn't be paying attention either. So I only sponsor 9 to 10 at night. So as Mo asked the question, when I ask someone, I have a spot open on, you know, Sunday, Tuesday, and Thursdays, 9 p.m. to 9:30, you know, Eastern Standard Time, and they say, well, that's not really convenient. Okay, you'll need to find another sponsor. Nothing wrong with them not being convenient, but that's what works for me, because that's when I can be 100% available to that person. You know, how do you want to handle the tools? Do you want someone to go to meetings? Do you want someone to do writing assignments? How do you want to handle the food? Do you want them to commit it every day on the phone? Do you want them to commit it via text or email? Do you want to not deal with the food at all? I don't recommend that, but that is your choice. but those are the things you're going to do. And that way, when you say to someone, are you willing to go to any lengths? Instead, you're saying, this is what I require as a sponsor. And you can have requirements as a sponsor. I don't barter and negotiate with sponsees. I love when someone calls me and interviews me to see if I'm good enough for them to sponsor. I'm like, dude, there's 6 people behind you dying. Find someone else. You know what I mean? So you tell them what your requirements are. This is my time available. You need to, like, for I'm just going to give my thing, not saying everyone does this, but you know, they have to listen to this Vision for You meeting 20 to 30 minutes every single day. I don't care what it's like, if it's live or recorded. And that's because I work with a lot of people across the country, and I don't know what their home meetings are like. I have no idea. I know they will hear a solution on a Vision for You, so I want them to listen to that. They have to call 2 recovered people a day. They can call 10 people. I don't care. But I want them to call 2 recovered people a day. And then they text me their food before they eat it, meaning the night before or the morning of. And they text me their food. They text me the 2 people they spoke to and maybe a bullet point what they talked about and 2 things they heard on the meeting. So, and then I talk to them 3 days a week. Now, the reason I require them to commit their food is not, I am not following their food. I am not critiquing their food. I want the food decisions shut down. I don't want you going through the day, what am I going to eat? 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 I want that chatter shut down so you can commit your food. I'm not saying that's what you have to do. I have found that most effective for me. How have I found that out? Because I've done other things and they haven't worked. I just require this is for me personally, I require their food before they take that first bite. And depending on what their schedule is, they can text me separately, they can text me whenever they do it, or email. I find people over 50 want to email, under 50 tend to want to text. So I'm not really invested in that. But I just find I want them connected, because I only talk to them 3 days a week. I want them to start building up a fellowship. Once again, for me personally, is I want them to get a connection with the fellowship and with God, not with me. I want to wean them off of me as soon as possible. So that's the way that I personally do that. Okay. What I absolutely love is when I sponsor someone, they get through the steps. And most people will sponsor like their sponsor because that's what they're comfortable with. I love when they start to change, because God starts using them and their talents. I always remember this time I took this girl through the steps, and she announced herself as a sponsor on this Vision for You meeting, and she got 9 phone calls. And I thought, I'm going to have to talk this girl down from a ledge. And she's like, okay, Kim, I got 9 phone. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to get a phone bridge. I'm going to take them all through steps 1 through 3, see how many are left. And at step 4, I'm going to separate them and take them through the rest of the steps. And I'm thinking like, oh my God. And then I remembered she's a corporate trainer. Of course that's what she's going to do. That's her talents. That's her skill set. You know, I often talk, if you want a warm and fuzzy sponsor, you're not going to ask me. Thank God there are warm and fuzzy sponsors out there, because people may need that. They're just not going to be attracted to my message. Does that make sense? I also tell them what I'm not offering. I'm not your girlfriend. I'm not someone you're going to call so you don't eat tonight. I'm not going to take your bitching. We're on the phone for a half hour. We're in the book. I have to tell you, even 9 years in, I don't always trust myself, but I trust the book. And I find something magical happens when you open up the book and you start sharing your experience with another person. And you don't need to do it alone. If you're not sure, you simply say, let me get back to you. Let me ask a recovered person. I want to talk about that guy, Jim. Don't say, okay, if you don't know who Jim is, ask questions. We're here as a community. That's most of my questions after I get people through the steps, is about sponsoring. Because when you're going through the steps, a lot of times you're scared. You can't remember stuff. You're going to learn it when you get through the steps. So I'm going to veer off. The big book, let me just say this. The big book really is very clear in this chapter how to go through it. But it's kind of what we did this weekend. They're telling you to talk about problem, 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 problem. And when they say, how did you escape? That's when you hit them with step 2. We talked about that yesterday. Half the instructions in the big book are on step 1. I used to give beginner meetings, and I would tell someone about a 4th step, and they'd be like, I want to lose 30 pounds. Like, that's not relevant to them. You want to talk about the allergy of the body and the mental twist. There's a line here that says, give them a sketch of your drinking. So I happen to be 52 years old. I'm from New Jersey. I've never been married. 12 years of Catholic school, never had children, and I'm an accountant with a master's in accountancy with a fraud and forensic minor. How many of you can relate to me? Got one. So apparently that's the only person I can help with my story, right? I'm supposed to give a sketch of my drinking. How many of you remember swearing off over and over again? How many of you remember coming to a beautiful weekend like this and binging your brains out on Monday because you're terrified? That's what we're talking about. You're giving a sketch of your dream. What does it look like with the allergy of the body in you and the mental twist in you? That's where we're going to catch people. Our life stories, we spend way too much lifetime on. And then you're going to bring them through the steps. So I want to talk about how we can carry this message on a more global way. One of the things it talks about, you know, it says vigorous, what was the word they used? Intensive work with other alcoholics. I always tell people, if sponsoring is convenient, you're probably not doing enough. If sponsoring is convenient, you're probably not doing enough. It should be inconvenient. My friend of mine says she's divinely inconvenienced on a daily basis. I also feel every interaction I have with the still suffering, I'm working with somebody. Personally, I don't like the word sponsor because, once again, my own experience and prejudice is I thought my sponsor was someone I committed my food to. I told him what tools I did, and I would complain how I didn't have a boyfriend. That's what a sponsor meant to me. I work with people. I take people through the big book. That's what I do. So I consider any interaction. So actually, most of you, everyone in here, I've worked with you this weekend, right? Because I've carried the message to you. So think about that at your own meetings. Do you come in 5 minutes late and leave 5 minutes early? You know, when the meeting is over, are you trying to find out from your girlfriends where you're going to coffee? And yet there's a person who's never been to OA that's in the corner all alone? Or that person that is coming back from relapse and is humiliated and nobody's coming up to them? We actually, in my home group, stopped the We Care list. Do you guys have We Care list out here? Be careless is something that you just sign in your name and so you can get phone calls, and it goes around the room once normally for people to put their phone numbers in there and a second time to take their phone numbers. The biggest complaint I get in Overeaters Anonymous is nobody returns phone calls. So you have someone scared to death who puts their name in a book and they do not get a phone call. And they might pick up that phone and call someone and the person doesn't call them back. So we eliminated it and we said, you got to start approaching people. And with phones today, it's so easy. Just bring up the phone, take their number and call them. If you're getting phone calls, return the phone call. That's what people, you know, we need to do. How is your meeting set up? Is your meeting set up in such a way that you are coddling disease? Are you just letting people complain all the time? Is there any focus on steps, on abstinence? I have to tell you, in my area, I hesitate to say because I haven't checked lately, but there was a time that my meeting was the only meeting that had an abstinence requirement to even lead the meeting. You could be absolutely, in fact, one meeting decided they were going to do it, and it was 7 days. And I was in the meeting, and they said, think about it. You can be totally binging today, and we'll give you the key to this church, and you can come back, and you'll have your 7 days. I had a sponsee that had been in AA and NA for like 5 years, and she went to an OA meeting in my area, and the person leading the meeting was, you know, grossly, morbidly obese. Said that she'd been in OA for 20 years, had 2 weeks of abstinence. Everyone's clapping, and she's wondering why people are clapping. And then the woman came up to her after the meeting and said, oh, honey, this is OA. Sometimes 2 weeks is the best we can do. So carrying this message is not just about us individually. What can we do as meetings? How do we support that? And I tell you, it takes a lot of work. I'll tell you, for me, just once again, my personal experience when I recovered, there was no one doing the big book in my area. I went to AA meetings, and there was another phone meeting besides Vision that I would listen to, and we started to listen in my house because it wasn't with Vision. I mentioned this to somebody. Vision is a registered Overeaters Anonymous meeting, and I know meetings that do not have strong people. They'll use Vision for your recordings as their guest speakers, and it's okay because it's a registered OA meeting. You can have Harlan or Lori or Ruth or somebody and have them just listen to 20 minutes of that recording in your meeting and then use that as a launching pad for sharing. So this meeting was not a registered meeting, so we did it in my house. And for those of you who listen to Vision, I'm sure you have favorites, so we would fast forward to the people we liked. And this gentleman always shared last, so we knew he would go after he shared, he would go to the next paragraph. And we would listen to 3 or 4 people, and then we would practice this new way of sharing, not about our life, but about the steps and what the big book means to us. And then eventually we started asking meetings, can we bring panels to you? And we would talk about chapters. And then eventually we did a whole series in my home group, and after that series we switched our format to be a page-by-page big book study. And we were trying to help people, so we were grabbing people after the meeting, and we were going through the doctor's opinion with them. And now it's a formal step one meeting. We have our regular meeting, and we have a step one meeting afterwards for that. So it continues to grow. So ask yourself, how are your formats? Are your formats set up in such a way? Now, I'm going to say how I feel is what works, and you can disagree with me, and that's okay. I think it's ridiculous that you can't mention food in an OA meeting. And I don't know about you, but when someone says a round thing that's cream, I sit there start thinking about what the fuck are they talking about. It's more distracting than if they would just say donut, you know? I can't imagine an AA meeting saying that frothy brown substance with bubbles in it, you know? It's crazy. We are a compulsive overeaters. It's okay to say food. If saying food is going to trigger someone to eat, maybe we should offer to take them through the steps so that doesn't trigger them to eat. We often talk about crosstalk. First of all, crosstalk is not a tradition. Everyone says it's a tradition. If we're supposed to be discussing the steps, how can we not have crosstalk? Doesn't mean that you're going to tell someone. I think what my experience is, crosstalk means I can say whatever the heck I want, you guys cannot call me out on it. Or I want to complain about my mother, and you guys can't give me advice. If we are talking about the steps and what it means in our life. There should be no reason someone can't say, wow, you know, I'm so glad that Melanie said that, because I used that 10th step in the same way with my mom that she used with her mom. Let me tell you how that worked for me. That's not crosstalk. We need to have a discussion with that. We need to be willing to be uncomfortable if someone's going off on a tangent. Not in a meeting, maybe after the meeting, saying, listen, you know, this meeting really focuses on the big book or the 12 and 12 or the abstinence book. We try to refrain from personal sharing, if that's what your group conscience does. What does your format look like? Can you imagine in an AA meeting someone getting up and saying, let me tell you about step 4. But yesterday I had a couple beers, but, you know, I was really just a vodka person, so I'm still sober. Yet how many times in OA do we have people say, yeah, I had dessert last night, but let me tell you about step 10. Or I don't really think there's such a thing as abstinence. You know, abstinence to me means I just ask God to tell me what to eat, and whatever I eat is my abstinence. I can't imagine that. So are we supporting disease or are we supporting recovery? Are you using your talents to help Overeaters Anonymous as a whole? I am so grateful for intergroup people because I can't stand intergroup. But how can I support intergroup? Because intergroup is going to be the one that's going to be helping the local meetings, right? I'm so grateful for people that can make flyers and are creative because I don't have a creative bone in my body. I'm so grateful for the people that, you know, and in my meeting too, we make sure that we have abstinence requirements for service positions, but also have service positions with no abstinence requirement because we want to get people involved. So to lead the meeting, you have to have 6 months and through all 12 steps. But to greet, you don't need anyone. And when we give out the steps and traditions, we always try to give it to someone we don't recognize to help them feel welcome in the group. What is your meeting doing for that? I often think, too, that we use anonymity as a way to hide. And once again, I know this is going to contradict some people's experience, but I just want to tell you my experience. We say you have to find someone who's recovered. You have to find someone who's recovered. Who's your sponsor? I can't tell you. I need to have people to talk with. Can you tell me who you sponsor? I don't tell people who I sponsor. We're not supposed to be anonymous to each other. That's one of the things I tell my sponsees. If you work with me when you're through those 12 steps, your name's going to be texted out to whoever needs help. Because number one, there's a lot of people that need help. And number two, the way you're going to stay abstinent is by helping other people. So how are we helping other people? What are we doing to make sure that OA is going to be there for our children and the next generation? Do I love this fellowship enough to say some truths that maybe people don't want to hear? There's a line in Vision for You. It talks about being on the firing line. It is so uncomfortable. It is so uncomfortable to say stuff that people don't want to hear. But I'm so grateful to the people in this program that told me what I didn't want to hear. The people who told me what abstinence meant. The people who told me that it wasn't good enough just to be abstinent and cause havoc in my house. The people who called me in my 10 steps, like I was telling you about, the people who told me the truth and didn't just agree with me. And that's one of the reasons I'm up here saying this. And I'm grateful it's at the end because maybe you guys wouldn't have come back after this. So I'm going to end with my favorite promise in Working with Others. On page 100, it starts out with the first full chapter, Both You and the New Man. So it says, both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. I hope you guys persist. I hope it doesn't end on Monday morning, that you had this great experience and you're going to go back to whatever you did that if you're in relapse. Or maybe you'll challenge yourself. You have 3 sponsees. Too much for me, but maybe I'll take on 1 extra person. When we look back, we realize the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Here's my favorite promise. Follow the dictates of a higher power and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. I love that because it doesn't matter what's going on. My dog's hurt at home with a dog sitter. My parents are having issues. I might get laid off this year. But you know what? Because of this program, I feel safe and protected. My life is no longer dependent on outside circumstances. So I just want to end with this one story that I love that I heard on a podcast. So there's a little boy. He finds out there's a circus in town, and he wants to go to the circus. And he asks his dad, and his dad said, if you do all your chores, you're going to get to go to the circus. So he does all his chores, and the dad gives him $1 to go to the circus. And he goes into town, and there's this big parade. And he sees things he's never seen before. He sees acrobats, and he sees people swallowing swords, and he sees tigers and bears and lions, and he is over the moon. And at the end of the parade is a bunch of clowns that come out of this car, and they're laughing and they're joking, and the one clown goes in front of him and tips his hat, and he puts the dollar in the hat, and he goes home. Having no idea, he didn't see the circus. The circus was under the big top. These wonderful weekends is the parade. You're seeing people here who have recovered. And actually, let's stop for a minute. All of us who have absolutely gone through all 12 steps and have had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, raise your hand. These are the people that you want to talk to if you're suffering today. But the big top is working one-on-one. I go to my home group because I need to find people to work with. I used to go to my home group like a gas station. I'm going to fill up and then I'm going to leave. I know I now go there because I need to work with people if I'm going to stay abstinent. So the big top is one-on-one in a Denny's or, a coffee shop working with people. Don't miss out on the circus because the parade can be so entertaining. So thank you, everyone, for listening. And we do have 3 minutes. Does anybody have one question or? Okay, that was asked yesterday about not doing a step four in ourselves. The big book does not mention putting yourself on your step four or your step nine, but we love to do that because we love to talk about ourselves. So in step three, we learn that we're selfish. They're driven by a thousand forms of fear, that selfish and self-centeredness is the root of our trouble. So what we're trying to do is get detached from self, detached from ego. So we're not going to put ourselves on our fourth step because we have to look at what outside of ourselves to get that stuff removed. Does that make sense? Correct. So you're going to get to that fourth column about your resentments, your fears, and your sex conduct, but it's about other people, not about you. Right. Okay, I can tell people want to leave, so thank you. You guys, I made a mistake. This actually ends at 10:45. So everyone's ready to leave, but if anyone wants to ask questions for 15 minutes, I'll answer questions. I'm sorry. I totally was messed up with the time. So if anybody does want to ask questions, they can ask questions. Sorry. Okay, actually, we did have one question. I had mentioned yesterday about that if we're only committed to this program for 98%, the 2% will take us out, and someone asked me to expand on that. So it's where I don't think that this program applies. So, for example, if with my job, if me getting laid off, if I think that I have the power on my own to keep my job, and I'm thinking I have to do this on my own, that's exactly where my disease is going to get in. So the reason I say 98% isn't just my way of expressing the fact that no matter how little it is that we think isn't relevant to the 12-step program, that's exactly where the disease is going to find a way to weasel itself into to get us. Does that help, Stephen? Okay. For me personally, it's 30 minutes because I have a hard time paying attention much longer than that. So I actually usually have two 30-minute appointments. So my appointments are 9 to 10. I have sponsees that once they're said, they said 30 minutes is way too short, and they wind up doing an hour. So that has more to do with my personality than anything else. For me personally, I do 3 times a week on the phone. For local people, we meet at a Wegmans. I don't know if you have a Wegmans, but they have a really nice section upstairs. And we meet for like an hour and a half on a Saturday once a week when it's face-to-face. I shared this yesterday, and I don't recommend this. I didn't have a sponsor. Well, that's what I'm saying. I didn't have a sponsor that took me through the steps. I used a phone meeting, and I used recovered people to help me, and I got someone to take my fifth step. So what I have in my life is what's called mentors. So they're recovered women that have been through the steps that I utilize for questions in 10 and 11. It's totally different for everybody, and that's why I think as a sponsor you should be open with your sponsees how you do it. That's what I say. I tell people that I take people through 2 to 3 months, and then at that point they call me with questions. A lot of people want much more contact than that, and I tell them to find that. I've had people I've taken through the steps, and then they say they need that, so they've gotten another sponsor once I got them through the steps. Yeah, so that's totally between people. I gave someone the post-it. Sorry. Sorry. Anyone else? Stacy? Okay, this is for big book nerds. We get really freaked out about articles and stuff like that. In my phone here, I have my cover. I have all my little pop ups. I need to get rid of them. Crap. So my lock screen says is a picture of Bill Wilson, and it says, our chief responsibility to the newcomer is an adequate representation of the program. So that's what the message is. Am I giving people an adequate representation of what the big book is saying, what the steps are saying? Am I trying to keep my opinion out of it and just say what the steps are? I share my experience, not my opinion, if that makes sense. Well, to me, the steps in the book are the same exact thing. But once again, the big book is the original source. To me, it's the most effective source. But if you're taking someone through the OA workbook or other material, then you're carrying the message in that book. So we want to be as close to whatever the source is that we happen to be using. And basically, that's the steps, right? So what's the disease, step 1? What's the solution, step 2? And what do I have to do to get it, steps 3 through 12? Steven? I don't. I am totally a big book person. I don't use any other literature. I'm a big reader, but I don't read the big book. I study it. So when I'm reading sci-fi and spy novels and stuff like that. I personally do not. There's a lot of good AA material. There's a lot of good OA material, but I'm just not someone that studies that stuff, which is probably negligent, but I don't. Anyone else? No, I do not, but I'm wearing a t-shirt that says happy, joyous, and free, by the way. Okay. I meant to tell you that.
On page 132,
if you know. I don't know how to tell that for you. I can just tell you that the way I found this AA meeting was listening to podcasts, and I heard a Philadelphia accent. And once I found a big book meeting, they all know each other. So you might just want to, I don't know how it is in Los Angeles, but yeah, you got it. Yeah, I mean, big book people tend to stay together. So once you get hooked in, it's usually easier, but it's sometimes it's hard to get hooked in. But that's awesome. Okay. You know, this is totally unrelated, but I remember after a thing where I was dating all these losers, you know, and a friend of mine said to me, Kim, the problem is that you're dating these losers. The problem is you're saying yes when they ask you out. And I don't mean that, but what I'm saying is that, you know, not everyone who asks you to sponsor you is willing to do the work. So my suggestion is next. You know, I don't fire anyone, but I get fired a lot because I'm really clear on what I require. And if they don't do the requirements, they just stop calling me. If I say you have to do something and they call me and say they didn't do it, I say, okay, call me at our next appointment. And they don't usually don't. If I sit there and talk to them and chat with them, they're going to keep calling me. So my suggestion is to do an inventory on who you want to be as a sponsor, create an ideal, and then that's what you're going to do. And you're going to start attracting people. But understand that, like we said, there's not a lot of people. I always say to people, if you're not in, you know, a sponsor right now and you're reading the Working with Others, not only ask if you as a sponsor, are you sponsorable? Because what I find is a lot of people want to sponsor, but most people do not want to be sponsored. So what you're looking for is not just people who want to sponsor, people who want to be sponsored. And that for me, once again, this is for me personally, that's why I like working with a bunch of people. Because when I work with one or two, if one of them drop, I get panicked. I start to like freak out. I know I need a sponsor. If I'm working with five or six, if one drops out, I think I mentioned in the beginning, but I had a sponsee that picked up this weekend. We were supposed to have a fifth step tomorrow. I told her to gave her an assignment. I'll talk to her. And the fifth step is off. Obviously, she picked up. I had another sponsee text me this morning who I brought through last year who picked up. And she said, I'm beaten up. Can you help me again? Probably put her in that slot. And just in the flow. But if someone's not doing the work, then, and I will say to people, listen, there's people dying in these rooms who are willing to do the work. I'm really sorry, but I need to take someone else on. And when you're ready, call me. Yes. Well, I think there's only two requirements for a sponsor. They have to absolutely gone through all 12 steps and have had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. Those are the two requirements you're looking for. Because anybody who hesitates on either of those two questions probably isn't recovered. So I don't know if you want to ask that. I don't know. You're going to have to make a decision whether that's working for you or not. I'm not sure. You know, I would ask her if you feel it's going slow. I like to tell people how long it's going to take to get through the steps. So you can ask your sponsor how long it's going to take to get through the steps. If a sponsor told me a year and a half, I'd probably move to somebody else because I know myself. I can't keep the food down for a year and a half without having a spiritual awakening. But I don't know. Nance.
You mentioned that. Is it on? You mentioned that you're going to take someone through again in a slot that opened up that you had already worked with. I, as a disciple of this method that you went through, if I give people a couple of chances and if they can't pick up the, you know, start to at least look at the simple kit of simple tools, I cut them loose. And I And I told another friend, dear friend, in program that has excellent recovery, you know, that I wouldn't do it again. And she said, oh, I do. And she has really good recovery. And I'm just wondering, you know, what is your feeling about working? Like, she, you know, I sort of feel like if it didn't work the first time, I only have one, I'm a one-trick pony. I only have one way to do it. What do you think?
So I don't think there's one answer to that. Anyone who says there's one answer to that, I get a little nervous. Every time I take on a new sponsee, I ask the same question. Can I be useful to this person? So if someone picks up, I ask, can I be useful to this person? Sometimes the answer is yes, and sometimes the answer is no. I haven't talked to this girl. I don't know where she's really at. So I'll have to talk to her, and then I'll tell her I'm going to pray over it, see if I can be useful to her. Because that's what we want to do. We want to be useful. So there's no one-size-fits-all type of answer. And well, this is the last question. I'm sorry. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. The 12 and 12 is currently in my bedroom holding up my molding because it started to fall. I don't use the 12 and 12. I appreciate it when I hear about it, but I'm just a big book person, so I don't personally use it. If someone picks up, it's kind of like I was just talking with Nancy. They have to go back to step one, but I get into prayer how I can be useful to that person. Sometimes I don't feel like I can. And if I can, I've created some assignments that I think are useful. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. I would say 50% of the time, I'll give them an assignment and they'll call me back, and 50% of the time, I never hear from them again. But it's not one answer. I do believe when someone picks up, you have to take them to step one. Because you know what? They're in step one. They might want to say they're in step 10 or 9 or 5. They're in step one if they're actively eating. So the question is, can I be useful to that person and bring them back and hopefully have a step one experience? Okay. And thank you guys. I'm so sorry I screwed that up. I didn't realize the time thing. So thank you.